Hey, good morning, everyone. I want to thank, first of all, our sponsor for this morning, Becky and Avi Katz, and their family in memory of David Grossman, their beloved father and grandfather, the learning should be Leilui Nishmas, David Ben Menachem Manis, Zichrono Levracha. So I want to thank him. And I want to welcome you all. Today, obviously, we're going to talk about Parshas Yisro, which in many regards is a very packed Parsha, and in many regards, it's not a very packed Parsha. But to begin the Parsha, I want to take you back a year. And I just watched it online again, and it was just as striking the 15th time I watched it as it was the first time I watched it. Some of you might remember last January, there was an incident on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And the incident took place between a group of white Catholic students and a Native American, where the Catholic white students were staring at the Native American. And at least the image that was projected on the videos that you and I saw and that went viral across the internet at comet-like speed almost seemed like these students were taunting this poor African Native American. Okay? The video shows these boys in Make America Great hats, red MAGA hats, and they're laughing and they're looking on and they're taunting as this individual is playing the drums, seemingly innocent. And if you remember what happened last year, that video went viral, as I said, at comet-like speed, and everyone made their judgment based on seeing about a 30-second clip of that video. And the narrative that was created was what you and I would have also likely concluded, which was this was everything wrong with America now. Everything wrong with America, white nationalists, right? The whole Make America Great Again movement was that these young students are taunting people who are, so to speak, less privileged indigenous people, and therefore it fit a narrative that the mainstream media was clearly looking to fit. If you recall afterwards, the rest of the video came out. And the rest of the video portrayed a very different picture than the 30-second clip that you and I had first been exposed to. There was one problem. And that is, once you see the 30-second clip, and once you make your first initial impression, it's very hard to undo that impression, even though you now have a broader experience and a broader picture. That episode is irrelevant to me. And yet, I think it's something that the Torah was very worried about many, many, many thousands of years ago. And that's what I want to talk to you about for a few minutes. Our society, which rushes to judgment, which seems to view things from a binary perspective, is exactly what the Torah was nervous about. And this plays out more than anywhere else in the Parsha that you and I are going to read this coming Shabbos. Because the Parsha is about many storylines, as I started off by saying. Yisro, of course, reunites with his son-in-law Moshe Rabbeinu and sets up a whole court system for how Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be able to manage the workload of everything that the Jewish people are expecting upon him. He's one person. They are many. Jews are not necessarily known as non-complainers. And Moshe Rabbeinu is trying to figure out how he's going to bear the brunt of adjudicating all these cases. His father-in-law comes and he sees him and he says, "Whoa, we have to change the system." Story number two is obviously the signature moment in all of not just Jewish history, but world history. And that is the receiving of the Ten Commandments. The Aseres Adibros, which we'll read about this coming Shabbos in Shishi, of course, in many regards, is the epicenter of our faith. And for good reason. We place enormous emphasis on the Aseres Adibros. We talk about believing in Hashem, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hotzeisicha Me'eretz Yitzrayim. What more important than the formal statement that I am God? Lo Yelecha Elokim Acharim. By the way, not only am I God, but I am an exclusive God. There's something called monotheism. There are no other gods other than me. And therefore, you can't take my name in vain. Lo Sisa Hashem Hashem Elokecha Lashav. Those who are doing the Daf Yomi just came across this pasuk about a week ago. Right? You're not allowed to take my name in vain. And then, of course, we get to Shabbos, we get to honoring your mother and father. These are the most critical, fundamental, foundational principles of all of Judaism. And we give the Aseres HaDibros so much focus because it's the moment where God reveals himself to mankind. And just think about that for a second. How revolutionary that is. That God, who is infinite, who dwells in the heavens or wherever we want to imagine him, God communicated with human beings. And through that, he gave us a mechanism to be able to communicate with him for eternity. And that's, of course, through the Torah, HaKadoshah, the sacred Torah that God gave to us. So here you have this moment in Jewish history where God comes and directly reveals himself to mankind. What greater moment could you ever think of in world history than that? This is the story in the Torah that is accompanied by thunder and lightning. And the Torah does that specifically because it wants to draw our attention to this. And it's essentially a way of highlighting this story in Tanakh and saying, this is really important. Thunder and lightning get your attention. In my house, by the way, it's the hair dryer. My youngest daughter is scared of loud noises. So in our house, that's two things. That's my sneezing. I'm not a soft sneezer. And number two, it's the hair dryer. So my oldest daughter was blowing her hair last night, and it caused a whole pandemonium in the Moskowitz house last night, right? So why? Because noises grab our attention. So Hashem was no different. He wanted to make an experience for Klal Yisrael. So there's thundering and lightning. There's enormous fanfare and buildup and preparation required for Maamid Har Sinai. And because of all that, at least in BRS, what are we going to do this Shabbos? We're going to stand. That they're going to go to read the Aseres HaDibros, and we are going to stand in commemoration of that experience. And yet, and this is what I want to grapple with you this morning, is despite the fact that the Aseres HaDibros is the seminal moment in world history, God reveals himself to the Jewish people, thunder and lightning, fanfare, preparation. We know that Chazal also bent over backwards to minimize our focus on the Aseres HaDibros. So what do I mean by that? Well, on the one hand, we do not reference the Aseres HaDibros in our davening anyway. And that is surprising. You would think this is the most important moment in world history. We would want to commemorate that every single day. We do not. Number two, nowhere in halachic literature will you find that the punishment for violating one of the Aseres HaDibros is any worse than the punishment for violating any other commandment in the Torah. And the flip side is also the case. Nowhere do you find that the reward is any better for fulfilling one of the Aseres HaDibros, categorically more than any other mitzvah in the Torah. Now we know that there are, right? Kabeda Savicha Vesimecha. We know that's a guarantee for long life. But that has nothing to do with the construct of the Aseres HaDibros. There's no Gemara, there's no Shulchan Aruch that says that 603 mitzvos are important, but 10 of them are really halachically important. And if you violate one of those 10, the punishment's going to be worse than any of their 603. And if you fulfill one of those 10, the reward is good. You don't find that anywhere. In a Gemara, in a Midrash, in a Halacha, in a Rishon, in an Achron, you do not find that anywhere. And despite the fact that I just said here in BRS, and I specifically said here in BRS, because I don't know the custom in other shuls, is to stand for the entire Aliyah of the Aseres HaDibros. Many of us are familiar with the famous Teshuvah of the Rambam, where the Rambam explicitly tells his congregation not to stand during the Aseres HaDibros. And the reason why the Rambam tells his community not to stand for the Aseres HaDibros is because he doesn't want me and you to think that the Aseres HaDibros are categorically any better than any other mitzvah in the Torah. And so you have this tension inherent in the Aseres HaDibros. On the one hand, it's the seminal moment in world history. It's the moment where the creator of the universe literally exposed himself and revealed himself to human beings, finite, imperfect, mortal human beings like me and you. And on the other hand, Chazal specifically restrict our focus on the Aseres HaDibros because they don't want us to place too much emphasis on it. They don't want us to think that these 10 are any better or any worse than any other of the 603. So why did Chazal do that? Because I would have ventured to say that if we came into this class this morning, and I had taken a show of hands and said, who think the Aseres Dibros are really important? Every single hand would have shot up. And yet, it's very clear, it's explicit, that the rabbis wanted to temper our excitement, or our focus, and our emphasis on the Aseres Dibros. Why is that the case? Now, there is a historical reason for this. In the Gemara, again, those learning Daf Yomi, we did this about 24 days ago. Those doing the Daf Yomi, I'm sure you remember it, like you remember breakfast this morning. No, there's no way anyone remembers it, right? So the Gemara in Brachos on Daf Yud Beis tells us that they actually wanted to place the Aseres HaDibros inside davening each and every morning. The Gemara goes through a whole slew of things that they wanted to add to davening, but for various reasons was not included into davening. One of those, for example, is the Parsha of Balak, story of Bilam. And the Gemara says that they wanted to put into davening, but they were worried about making davening too long. Right? Apparently, the Gemara never came into shul on a Monday or Thursday. That Parsha's Balak, they were all concerned about. I could have chosen other areas as well. But in that context, the Gemara says, why don't we include Aseres HaDibros? Here you have the Aseres HaDibros. God reveals himself, so important. Everything you and I came in here thinking, and until Moskowitz ruined it for me, I thought the Aseres HaDibros were important. And so the Gemara says, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Af Bigvulin Bikshu Likros came. In the surrounding areas, they wanted to read the Aseres HaDibros every single morning. Ella, rather, Shekvar Bitlum. But the rabbis prevented them from reading the Aseres HaDibros every single morning. Why? Mipnei tarumas haminin. What does that mean? Because the heretics are going to confuse us all. How are the heretics going to confuse us? So Rashi tells us, shelo yomru la'amei ha'aretz. The rabbis were concerned that they would come to simple people like me, and they would say, ein shar ha'torah emes, v'teidu she'en koren ela masha amar ha'kadosh baruch hu, v'shamu mipiv misinai. Because people were going to come at various points in history, and they were going to convince us that only these Aseres HaDibros were important to the exclusion of the rest of the Torah. And that the only part of the Torah that you really have to fulfill are these 10 things. Because that's the only part where we're told explicitly that God came and revealed himself to mankind. So I get it. Those 10 commandments are the really important ones. But the other 603, those are negotiable. Those are negotiable. Because they're not included in the Aseres HaDibros. And so the rabbis were afraid of that, says the Gemara. Historically, the rabbis were afraid that we would be convinced that certain mitzvos are more or less important than others. The rabbis said no. Everything has to be on an equal playing field. And even though you and I think that the Aseres HaDibros are so important, the truth is, well, we're not really sure what they are right now. Right? Because they're not categorically more important. The punishment isn't greater. The reward isn't greater. We're not reading it in davening. According to many, we shouldn't even stand up because we don't want any pasuk in the Torah to stand out above and beyond any other pasuk. But I'd like to suggest this morning, and this is what I want to speak to you about because it's weighing heavily on my mind, and I believe when I share it with you, it will weigh heavily on yours as well, is I think that there is a more fundamental reason for why the Chazal counterintuitively underplay the Aseres HaDibros. And that's for the following reason. We live in a world, and I don't need to tell you this, you guys know this as well, if not better than I do, but I know enough to know that we live in a society and in a world that yearns and craves for simplicity. Okay? I'll give you a few examples. You simply go online and you Google and you'll find that you can master French cooking in 6 easy classes. Right? They've obviously never met me. We know you read magazines, Money Magazine, and they're the 5 golden rules of retirement. Now you and I both know that retirement is not so easy, certainly managing money during retirement. We've been taught and indoctrinated that we can beat addiction with 12 easy steps. And so we live in a society where we want quick fixes and easy solutions to every single problem that's around us. And in addition to that, because we crave simplicity in our efforts and in French cooking and in, right? It filters its way down, I believe, into our overall philosophy and worldview. And it's made it the case that everything has become binary. You simply need to open up a newspaper or watch a news show to know that every single thing in our world is either or. It's either good or it's bad. You're either smart or you're stupid. It's always or never. You're either a Democrat or you're a Republican. You're either right or you're wrong. You're either with us or you're against us. That is how we have allowed ourselves to be molded. It's this quest for simplicity, because there's so much noise around us, that's actually made us simplify our lives into very short sound bites. So what goes viral on the internet? It's 30-second clips. It's memes on Instagram or Facebook. Right? It's these short little things which grab your attention. If you go on the news now, how much time do you have to speak? It's sound bites. Right? It's the best person who can get the quickest zinger the fastest is going to emerge successful on talk radio now, or on the news now, or in presidential debates now. Right? That's the whole game. Because no one wants long, drawn-out speeches. Right, I'm reading a book about Frederick Douglass now. I'm a nerd, I know. So, right? But when you think about, if you've read anything about John Adams, right? Those types of speeches would go, they'd be dead on arrival in our day and age. Dead on arrival in our day and age. Because the whole purpose is you have to grab people's attention, you have to do it as quickly as possible, okay? And you have to do it in as simplified a version as possible, because otherwise people are going to tune you out, okay? Same thing. We've been teaching on Tuesday nights a history of the American Orthodox rabbi. And one of the things that is humorous for me as I'm preparing my classes, and I'm speaking to the other rabbis who are preparing, is oftentimes when you'll research a rabbi from the beginning of the 20th century or the end of the 19th century, you'll come across their sermons. And it's actually comical to follow how sermons, drushas on Shabbos morning have evolved from the early 20th century until the beginning of the 21st century. And I noticed for myself the attention span, the speed at which you have to get people's focus on you, and if you lose them that quickly, they're gone the rest of the time. Right? There was a day and age when sermons went a lot longer than they go in our day and age. Right? And they're a lot less pop culture. In other words, they were much more formal, and it was a lecture. I remember when I was growing up, and I'm not saying that this is the ideal, but when I was growing up, we didn't have a rabbi. I grew up in Boston. So, because in Boston, everyone's a rabbi. Everyone's a professor. This guy was the chair of this at Brandeis. This guy was the chair of that at BU. And so every Shabbos, a different guy or woman would get up and share their dissertation. But drushas, when I was growing up, were between 45 minutes and an hour. Without exaggeration. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. So there's one individual who, I mean, you could have like grown a forest in the amount of time that it took him to say his drush on Shabbos morning. So he would speak, let's say, like once every 2-2.5 months. And it was, let's just say the Ashkamimim was a little more crowded those weeks. So what happened was, he used to bring in, I don't know if you guys remember, when I was a child, we had like these blue machberets, like these blue notebooks, right? You all know what they are. So he used to write his dissertation, what I'll call a sermon, in one of those machberets and bring it into shul. We didn't have an Erev at the time, so he'd bring it in before Shabbos. And he'd get up there and he'd, in very exciting tone, that was facetious, he would proceed to read his drasha. So there was one year where I guess a couple of guys had it, because they came in right before Shabbos and they went into the shtender, they took the machberet, and about 20 pages in, they wrote in big black marker, "Time to stop." Okay? So he gets up there on Shabbos morning. I'm not exaggerating, by the way. This is like as true can be. And he gets up there on Shabbos morning and he's... And he gets there and he laughs and he says, "I think you've all heard enough of me this morning." And he closes machberet and sits down. I don't know. That was pretty sad. But that's why I don't bring my drushes into shul on Erev Shabbos anymore. Right? So what I believe, and I would like to humbly suggest to you this morning, and build on this idea, is that it's exactly the day and age that you and I live in that Chazal were most nervous about. Our rabbis were nervous about us reducing Torah and reducing Judaism into a few simple sound bites. And they were nervous that if we highlighted the Aseres Adibros, that would become the equivalent of learning to cook French in six easy lessons. That there would be an easy way to approach Judaism. Judaism would be, keep these 10, the rest is all negotiable, but you want to be a good Jew, bada bing, bada boom, 10 commandments, most of us can do some of them, we're good to go. Chazal were nervous that we would live in a day and age of overly simplified sound bites, and they said that's not what Judaism is. That's not what Torah is. That's not what religion is. Listen to this quote by Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. He says, the Aseres Adibros, as such, is too simple a formula. We are keenly aware of the fallacies of oversimplification, of its tragically disappointing results, and even heretical consequences. Life is a harsh, intricate, complicated affair, and 10 rules alone are hardly sufficient to solve all of its formidable problems. The Torah is vast. Judaism is complex. Our relationship with Hashem is complicated. Our relationship with the world is complicated. Anyone who lives, at least remotely, in a modern Orthodox existence, no matter how you define that, as openly or closed, we all interact with the world. We know that's a very complicated interaction. Judaism was never meant to simplify that interaction. Judaism was meant to embrace the complication of that interaction. And that's why, if you look at the very first mishnah in Pirkei Avos, so what are we told? Right? We're told that it's the end of the prophetic era, and Chazal instituted three things to help us grapple with that post-prophetic era. What were those three things? So number one is establish a lot of students, right? Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, which makes sense. You have to promote Torah. You have to get it out there to the masses. Think Lubavitch, right? You know, you have to get to all corners of the world because people without prophecy are going to need to learn it from other rabbis. So you have to have a lot of students. Then they say Asu Siag LaTorah, which also makes sense. I get that. In other words, in a post-prophetic world where Torah is going to become more complicated, and the possibility of us violating certain precepts of the Torah is going to be much more of a danger. So Chazal instituted Gedarim. They instituted decrees to prevent us from ever coming to violate an Isser Deoraisa, which is most of our Judaism nowadays. And then what was the third thing that Chazal instituted? Heve Mesunim Bedin, which means don't rush to judgment. Now, if I were writing Pirkei Avos, and I were living in the first generation after prophecy, I'm not sure I would have nailed all three of them. Right? I could have surmised Asu Siag LaTorah. I get the notion of barriers, of having to put up restrictions to prevent us from... I get that. I get the slippery slope idea that if you do a little bit, then that's going to become a lot, and therefore you have to stop it at the little bit. I get that. I could have probably, maybe, if I were a lot smarter, surmised that. Amidu Talmidim Harbe, establishing lots of students. Again, I may have gotten that one. The notion that without prophecy, we have to figure out a way to get the Torah, which is our connection now to Hashem, to get it out to the masses. So we have to have a lot of students. We have to build up the yeshivas. Right? I could have gotten that also. There is no chance on the planet that any of us in this room, if we took an intellectually honest poll of ourselves, would have gotten Heve Mesunim Bedin. As one of the core, central, most important principles after prophecy. Don't rush to judgment. Don't rush to judgment. What a strange thing for Chazal to have told us as one of the three most important things for you and I to know. And perhaps the answer is exactly what you and I have been speaking about. That Chazal understood that there would become a temptation at various points in Jewish history for hasty judgments and short sound bites. And therefore, they warned us, don't rush to judgment. Understand that the world is complex, and that interactions are complex, and that religion is complex, and our relationship with Hashem is complex, and that Judaism was never supposed to be a one-string violin, but it was supposed to be a multi-string violin, right? It was supposed to be a mosaic of different colors and different shapes and different sizes. And it's navigating that, which actually forms the beauty of Judaism. Think about any painting you've ever seen. Think about any music you've ever listened to. And you know that if you're just playing one note, it is boring as sin. What makes music beautiful, what makes orchestra music beautiful, is that you have different notes and different instruments all playing on different planes, but when they join together, that's what makes the melodious music. Judaism is no different. Now, would it be easier for one violinist to get up on stage and play by him or herself? Of course it would be. Part of what makes an orchestra so difficult is that they spent years and years of practice to make sure that they're all in sync. It takes hard work to bring different voices and different sounds together, to work together in sync with one another. That's exactly what Chazal wanted us to be. Not to be that one-string violin, saying that let's be short sound bites, and let's be hasty judgments, and let's be a religion of simplicity. That was never the goal. Judaism, by its mandate, is supposed to be complicated and complex. Let me share a study with you, which I think drives this home. It was a study conducted in 2003 in Princeton University by a man named Alexander Todorov. And he surmised the following. Right, today is the New Hampshire primaries, first primaries in the country. Okay, New Hampshire people are going to go into the polls, and most of them are going to think that they have thought out and researched and done their due diligence to figure out exactly which Democratic candidate they want to nominate for the presidential slate. Todorov said to himself, I'll bet you all the money in the world that despite the fact that when you and I close the proverbial curtain on election day, I don't think we have curtains. Do we have curtains here in Florida? No. Right, so the proverbial curtain on election day, you and I think you're putting a lot of thought into who we're voting for, but the truth is that we're not. We're not. So to prove it, he took pairs of pictures of individuals, of candidates, and he showed them to thousands and thousands of people, and he asked them, which of these individuals do you think is more likely to be elected as an official here in our country? And he asked them to rate the competency of each person. Okay, so he showed two pictures, rate the competency of each person. Now, unbeknownst to the people that he was surveying, each picture was a congressional candidate between the years of 2000, 2002, in 2004, between the House and the Senate. And people, thousands and thousands of people, simply by looking at the pictures for a split second, accurately predicted who won the congressional races 73% of the time. Okay? Which means that he found that just by looking at a person's face for a snap second meant that you were making a judgment of that person that 73% of the time, three quarters of the time, accurately predicted who you and I actually voted for. Which means that when you and I think we're making intelligent decisions, we're really not. We're succumbing to exactly the fear that Chazal had for us. And that is a fear of oversimplification, of snap judgments, of looking at a person's face and judging them based solely on the way that they look. And that three quarters of people in New Hampshire are doing that today when they enter into the polls. And so despite the fact that we've had so many debates and so many advertisements and so much research, the majority, three quarters, are simply looking at a person's face and saying, you have that look. You have that presidential look, and therefore I am voting for you. And so it's not just Chazal that we're nervous about our oversimplification in our approach toward Judaism, in our approach to each other. But it's actually playing out in our day and age, in congressional and presidential politics. That study, by the way, was done over and over again with other candidates for governor, and every single time it proved the same result. Let me share with you a midrash. And this midrash drives home this exact point that I'm saying. And once I share the midrash with you, you'll say, of course that's what Chazal are articulating for us. The midrash is wondering about the spiritual state of Klal Yisrael as they leave Mitzrayim in their journey into Eretz Yisrael. And the midrash tells us that there were conflicting characteristics that defined the Jewish people during their sojourn in the desert. And so the Medrash says the following. It's a pasuk in Pirkei Avos. I'm sorry, a pasuk in Shir Ashir. Right at the beginning, where the pasuk says, Shchora ani v'nava. I am blackened, but I am also beautiful. Right? Black here is not a color, it's sin, right? It's connoting sin. So despite the fact that we were imperfect, we were also beautiful. That's what Shir Ashir is describing. And the Medrash says that dichotomy, that paradox, on the one hand we're shchora, on the one hand we're blackened with imperfections, and on the other hand we're also beautiful, defined Klal Yisrael throughout their entire journey in the desert. So for example, the Medrash says, on the one hand, shchora ani, we were blackened with sin in Mitzrayim. As the pasuk says, vayimoru bi v'lo avu lishmo ali, pasuk in Yechezkel, that they rebelled against me and that they didn't listen to me. So on the one hand, we were imperfect. But on the other hand, the Medrash says, v'nava, we were also beautiful in Mitzrayim. Korban Pesach, bris milah, we did things that were right in Mitzrayim. And so were the Jewish people either good or bad? The answer is we were both. We were shchor ani v'nava. We were both blackened with sin, but also beautiful. Then we come to the Yam Suf. In the Pasuk, once again, the Medrash says, shchor ani, we were blackened with sin at the Yam Suf. We read it last week. Vayimoru al yam v'yam suf. They rebelled against me, Hashem says, at the Yam Suf. And yet, what did we say at the Yam Suf? Zekeli v'anveyu. They pointed to God and they said, you are our God. You're our guy. V'nava. We were beautiful at the Yam Suf. Rasa shifcha layam. We experienced levels of revelation that were unheard of in world history. Shchor ani, says the Midrash, we were blackened with sin at Mara. As it says, Vayilonu ha'ama Moshe. Jewish people, right after the Yam Suf, right after seeing all these miracles, they start complaining to Moshe. Where's the water? And yet, v'nava. And yet, Vayitzak el Adonai, what did we do? We cried out to Hashem. Sometimes when you're ready to strangle your child, and then they come to you with those eyes and like the whimper, and you melt, and you're like, fine. So that's Hashem. Vayitzak el Hashem. Hashem says, but you're beautiful. You came to me crying to me. How could I say no to you? Shchor ani, says the Midrash. Then we come to our Sinai and we were blackened with sin. We sinned at Chet Ha'egel. And yet, v'nava, and yet we were beautiful because when God offered us the Torah, what did we respond? Nasa v'nishma. So you have the Midrash that's defining the state, defining the spiritual state of the Jewish people throughout the Torah. And it's not binary. It's not one or the other. That the Jewish people were either good or they were bad. No, they were both. Simultaneously good and bad. We had moments of goodness and we had moments of rebellion. Shchora ani v'nava. We were both blackened with imperfections, but also perfect with the beauty of our relationship with Hashem. In the Medrash, it's so striking. Because the Medrash wants us to know that that's what it means to be human. That's what it means to exist in the world. That's not all one or the other. That we're not overly simplistic, black and white assessments of good and bad, good, evil. The world doesn't exist like that. And you and I know that. The world is complicated, it's complex, it's colorful, it's multidimensional, it's both at the same time. Now, why is this so important? Why am I speaking about that this morning? Why have I showed you now from a number of different sources, whether it's our reluctancy to highlight the Aseres HaDibros and to overly simplify Judaism, whether it's the Medrash which highlights that the Jewish people were not simple when we came out of Mitzrayim, but that we were very complicated, emotionally, spiritually. Right? Why is it, Havei Misunim Bedin, the fact that Chazal go out of their way to remind us, don't rush to judgment. Because the world is complicated, and the world is complex, and people are complex. Why is this so important? Why would the Torah, in its very limited real estate, go out of its way to show us that the world is colorful and complicated? And the answer, I believe, is because that's what Judaism is. And the more you and I embrace that doctrine of Judaism, the less we'll be disappointed, and the more we'll glean from our relationship with Judaism. And the more we expect simplicity and perfection, the more we will be disappointed by our Judaism. Let me share with you a quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is a quote from Sacred and Profane, Kodesh and Chol, very famous article from the Rav, where he writes the following. For many religious world interpretations, secularism is a state of uncertainty and fear, unrest and apprehension. In other words, an existence without a relationship with religion means that you're living an existence of uncertainty and fear. What does religion do? Religion, however, in contradistinction to mundane vulnerability, is a state of security and impregnability. It is a peace and abiding hope, barricaded to the indifference of nature and the fluctuations of life. In this state, man finds purpose and direction, an anchor and a haven. He becomes the child of a merciful providence. So says the Rav, in the way most people conceive religion versus secularism, is secularism is misery, it's uncertainty, it's fear, it's anxiety, it's being thrown to the wolves without any order and direction. And religion provides peace and tranquility, in perfection. He says again, man, upon entering the religious domain, unburdens himself of the many responsibilities and duties which press upon his mind, and he is relieved of the task of eternal vigilance and self-observation. Religion, in the way most people conceive it, is supposed to make our lives a lot easier. It's supposed to unburden us of the uncertainties of the world, and the fears and the anxieties of the world, and the complexity of the world. It's supposed to make life a lot easier. Religion is the opiate of the masses. It's supposed to make us all happy. Says the Rav, when it comes to a Jewish perspective, nothing could be further from the truth. He says the following. The religious experience, in other words, now he's promoting the authentic Jewish perspective, is beyond granting man a hedonic status or spiritual complacency. Religion is not there to make us feel complacent. It's not there to make us feel happy all the time. To the contrary, the religious experience is fraught with pitfalls and continuing challenge. Religion is designed to be difficult. God, if man finds him, does not relieve the God seeker of his imperatives, but imposes new ones. Our relationship with Hashem doesn't make our lives easier. It actually challenges our lives in a much more significant way. Religion enriches life, gives it depth and multidimensional visions, but does not always grant man the comfort and complacency that nearly always spell superficiality and shallow-mindedness. Right? That's the key. Let me read that again. Religion enriches life. We all believe that, or we wouldn't be in this room right now. We believe it gives our life depth, but it does not always grant man the comfort and complacency that nearly always spells superficiality and shallow-mindedness. Religion, by definition, cannot be superficial. It cannot be simple. The equation of a happy and profound life is inadequate. The error of modern representatives of religion is that they promise their congregants the solution to all of the problems of life. Come to my church, come to my synagogue, we'll solve all your problems. That, says the Rav, is an expectation that religion does not fulfill. Religion, on the contrary, deepens the problems, but never intends to solve them. Religion deepens problems and never intends to solve them. Religion, by definition, is meant to be complicated and complex. It's meant to be something that we struggle with, that we battle with, that we grapple with. It's meant to be something that is not shchora ani or vina'ava, either imperfect or perfect, but it's both at the same time, because you and I both know that we have experiences like that regularly, where some mornings we feel like we are vina'ava, that our relationship with Hashem is perfect, and that the world is perfect around us, and that there are other moments in our lives where we feel shchora ani, where we feel imperfect and blackened with sin, and we feel distance from our relationship with Hashem. And sometimes it's not either or, but it's both at the very same time. Right? I personally feel that on Yom Kippur. Right? On the one hand, I'm dressed in white. I'm guaranteed forgiveness from God. And on the other hand, what do I spend the whole day doing? I'm terrible, I'm imperfect, I'm horrible, right? That's the embodiment. That's Judaism. That's our relationship with Hashem. It's multicolored. It's not simple. And it's not shallow. It's purposefully, by design, complicated and complex. But that's what gives it its true color. And so coming back to the whole notion of the Aseres HaDibros, why don't we highlight the Aseres HaDibros? Why don't we stand for them? Well, we do. But why doesn't everyone stand for them? And why isn't it different than the rest of the Torah? Because the Torah is not sound bites. And you can't boil down a relationship with Hashem to 10 easy mitzvos. And you can't learn it in 30 seconds. It's a lifelong journey of ups and of downs, of successes and failures, of distance and closeness. That is what a relationship with Hashem is meant to be. Listen to this quote from Rav Yehuda Amital. Rav Amital, of course, the founder and Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion, writes the following in an article titled "The Social Challenges Confronting the State of Israel." Okay, and listen to what he writes. Now, he writes this about Israel, and it still applies to Israel, but let's apply it to us here in the diaspora, in the current political climate, in the media outlets that you and I peruse in America in the year 2020. Says Rav Amital, "Simplistic thought, seeing issues as black and white, and an inability to perceive a whole and complex picture, has become a national epidemic." Wow. Seeing issues in simplified terms is a national epidemic. The media continually broadcast simple and uncomplicated messages. There's no time for involved explanations which require more airtime. The media prefer to emphasize the extremes, the black and white, the unequivocal, almost ruling out anything in between, anything gray or complex. There are no longer any doubts. The expression, without any doubt, is repeated over and over again by those interviewed, which is obviously an absurd statement, because there is always doubt, right? A situation has been created whereby simplistic thought has not only gained legitimacy, but has become the accepted language, even among circles which have pretensions as to the importance of their own opinions. Right? We live in a world where simplistic thought has not only gained legitimacy, but is the accepted language that you and I use, without any doubt. Right? Without any doubt, this is the case. No, there's a lot of doubt. There's a lot of other ways of viewing perspectives. Okay? He says, using complex thought, the religious person is able to understand the point of view of the secular person and vice versa. In other words, Judaism demands of us not to approach the world like Alexander Todorov in his study in Princeton University in 2003, where we make a snap judgment of a person or a situation based on the way that they look. But religion demands of us to not just see things in our own myopic way, but to view things from a broader perspective. In such a situation, the demands of each side towards the other side decrease. In other words, if I don't just view things from my perspective, but I'm able to see things from your perspective as well, then the gap between them actually grows smaller. Each side understands that things which are obvious to them are not necessarily obvious to the other. Sometimes they are even completely unintelligible. In the absence of such an approach, statements about openness are simply meaningless. The same can be said of the relationship between the political left and right. when one appreciates the complexity of Israel's situation, then one is able to recognize the legitimacy of each political opinion. We have reached a situation where simplistic thought is increasing the polarization of society and leading us to an inability to listen to others to the extent of delegitimization of other opinions. The distance between delegitimization and demonization is not all that great, and we have unfortunately been witness to the dangers of demonization of the other opinion. Does that not define the world in 2020? A world of overly simplistic thinking, a world of an inability to see things from another person's perspective, a world where delegitimization of another person and another person's views quickly descends into demonization, which has horrific consequences in society, and certainly amongst people on the margins of society. Rav Amital didn't write that in 2020. Rav Amital wrote that about 20 years ago. Okay? And it's even more relevant now than it was when he wrote it. Let me share with you one final quote, and this one I love. Prime Minister's Yehuda Avner, one of the greatest books. I say you can't be counted for a minion if you have never read this book. But that's probably heretical for a rabbi to say. But everyone, if you never read it, you should read it. Anyways, in the book he has the following. He's at a wedding. I don't need to go into the whole background and bore you. But he's at a wedding of an Arab by the name of Fayez. You can read the book on your own. And they're at the bar and he's schmoozing with another journalist. And he's asking the journalist, how do you do your due diligence? And the journalist says, I don't really have time to do due diligence. I basically watch TV as you do, and then I report on it, because who really has time to research anything in the life? He says, here's a good quote. He says, all we journalists are slaves to the all we journalists are slaves to the all news, all the time deadlines. We live by them, from one to the next. Who's got the time to do research? Our bosses want human action, not complicated facts. Now again, this was written in the long, long time ago, 50 years ago. Okay? Anyways, the person making the wedding, Fayez, comes over. And they invite him over for a drink. And he says the following. Fayez, this is the journalist saying to, says, Fayez, I have a question. I've been telling Yehuda here how tough it is for us foreign correspondents to get a grip on the conflict between you two. In other words, you being Yehuda Avner and Fayez, the Arabs. What do you think the chances are of you and Yehuda making up and shaking hands? The man sounded a hiccup. What do you mean, making up, shaking hands? Peace, making peace, letting bygones be bygones. Fayez looked up and down, lazy laughter in his eyes, and said in perfect Hebrew, you and me, peace? He removed his kafiyah, scrubbed his curly graying hair with his knuckles, pulled back his shoulders, lifted his jaw, and in a voice warped with whiskey said, Habibi, my friend, it won't work. Our genes are too different. You Jews come from everywhere. You are mongrels. We Arabs come from the desert. We are thoroughbreds. You think in subtleties. We think in primary colors. Yehuda Avner looked back at Fayez and says, what do you mean, primary colors? He placed a hand on my shoulder, whether in fellowship or to steady himself, I could not tell, and rambled on. Quote, primary colors means that there is nothing subtle about the desert. Everything there is in the extremes. Blazing hot days, icy cold nights, arid sands, luscious oases. That's why we Arabs are most at ease in the extremes. It's in our blood. We can be most overly generous one minute, overly greedy the next. Hospitable one minute, cutthroat the next. Fatalistic one minute, straining at the leash the next. And at this minute, he had me by the hand, I'm in a highly hospitable mood. So please come upstairs and join me at my daughter's wedding. The journalist, Fayez, walks away, and the journalist looks at Yehuda Avner and says, what in the world was that supposed to mean? He says, mystified. Bemused myself, I answered, I'm not at all sure. I'm not sure how much of that was him doing the talking and how much was the drink. But what I do know is that when it comes to our conflict, they do appear more at ease in the extremes. What I find so interesting about is that Fayez was 100% right. Right? There's two ways to live in the world. There's to live in a binary world, extremes. And then he compares us to, right? We live in subtleties. That's he called it out. We Jews are comfortable in the gray that exists within those extremes. We're comfortable with religion that is not either or. We're comfortable with situations that are not good and bad, but that there's a lot of gray and a lot of color in between. And in my mind, he nailed it directly on the head in his description of certainly Judaism and certainly the world in which you and I live. And so what I tried to do today is to struggle with you over why we don't magnify the Aseres Dibros more than we actually do. We're going to read about it this Shabbos. We know it was the most seminal moment in world history, and yet we know the Chazal purposefully tempered down our excitement about the Aseres Dibros. That's what you and I started with, and we struggled with why. And I hope what we developed throughout this class this morning is what I believe is the answer, which is that Chazal never wanted to boil down Judaism to sound bites and oversimplification. Chazal never wanted us to believe that we could conquer a relationship with God, that we could conquer our Judaism in 10 easy steps. That Judaism could be the type of religion no different than your French cooking classes or learning to type at 100 miles an hour. Right? What was that Mavis Beacon typing I grew up with? Right? 80 words a minute, right? So the Torah is never supposed to be that way. Judaism was never supposed to be that way. Religion was never supposed to be that way. We saw that beautiful comment of the Rav, that many people believe that religion is supposed to solve all our problems and make our lives a lot easier. Says the Rav, that's not the case. Judaism is supposed to give us meaning, it's supposed to give us purpose, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to come easy. It means that Judaism, in many regards, is going to create more problems than it's going to answer for us. And that's okay, because you and I live in a world that has a whole lot of gray in it. And that's what Judaism is supposed to teach us. We saw that immensely prescient comment from Rav Amital, where he lamented the oversimplification of the world around us as a national epidemic, where it's leading to delegitimization of each other and demonization of each other, simply because we don't understand that there's room in between what I think and what you think. That there's something called gray. That it's not either or, but there could be valid points that you're making and valid points that I'm making. And while ultimately we stick with our convictions and we believe firmly in what we believe in, at least let me be willing to see a little bit of wisdom in the way you think and in the way you believe. And if I do that, then I don't delegitimize you and I don't demonize you and I don't disregard you. But I see that there's wisdom beyond just what I am capable of understanding. Have a mesunim adin. It's what Chazal tell us. It's one of the three things they told us after the destruction of the base, the cessation of prophecy, is don't rush to judgment. Don't think you have all the answers. Don't think your perspective is the be-all and end-all of how the world was meant to function, because the world is not binary. It's not either or. It's not black and white. It's not right and wrong. There's a lot of gray. There's a lot of gray. And there's a lot of complexity that exists in the world around us. None of which I said today should ever be taken as a political statement. It's not. I used examples from politics because it's the world in which we live. But it is a plea. It's a plea. It's a personal plea. And I think many of you share this sentiment. It's a plea to commit ourselves to understanding that the world is not black and white, but the world is gray. To commit ourselves to understanding in conversations with each other, whether it be about the Yankees and the Red Sox, or Democrats or Republicans, or the fourth elections in Israel, whatever the case might be, to believe in our convictions, to do the research and thoughtfulness that goes into developing what we believe in, but also to understand that I can engage in a conversation with a person where there might be some semblance of truth to what they say as well. Maybe I can learn a little bit from the other person as well. And maybe instead of rushing to delegitimize the person and demonize the person, disregard the person and write them off, I can say, you know what, maybe it's society as a whole, maybe our communities as a whole are better if we're not that one string violin, but we're that orchestra made up of many different, diverse types of people from different perspectives and different backgrounds and different systems of belief that all come together with a sense of understanding and a sense of community, in a sense that the whole is always going to be greater than the sum of the individual parts. And I believe that that is ultimately the message that you and I should learn from the Aseret HaDibros, this parsha. Everyone have a